This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are continuing our coronavirus coverage today. Later in the hour, we'll take your calls, first with Steve Poftak, head of the MBTA, and then our daily panel of local health experts. First, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins is working to release inmates who are at risk for coronavirus and a low risk to public safety in an effort to avoid the spread of the virus inside incarceration. She joins us now on the line. Welcome back, DA Rollins.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I am well and trying to stay safe and healthy.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Let me ask you about this. Who are you trying to release and why, DA Rollins?
So I want to start with a larger understanding that once COVID-19, it became clear it's a pandemic and how we need to not yet shelter in place, all of us, but be really aware of social distancing. I started thinking about all the different vulnerable populations that were going to be impacted by that, whether it was our elderly community, whether it was possibly victims of violence, domestic violence and other types of violence and terror, whether it was our young children who sometimes go to school and that's the only safe place they have. Many of the reports of child abuse come from mandated reporters, school nurses, teachers, and that's all being removed. But I recognized as well that you don't stop being elderly if you're incarcerated, right? You don't stop being somebody's mother or father or brother or sister or partner if you're incarcerated. And we have a lot of those same populations behind the wall. So I wanted to make sure that individuals, certainly pre-trial, that are being held prior to them being found guilty of anything at all, that we need to be really aware of the fact that we're taking away their liberty and they're being sent to a place where they can't even comply with some of the basic requirements, the 6-foot distancing, the washing of the hands and keeping very sanitary. Many of our prisons and jails don't have hand sanitizer and soap. We just need to think about this as a public health issue, always weighing against the balance of my number one priority, which is keeping our community safe.
So that really flips the script on the perception of who is vulnerable in this moment. What do you say to critics who say, wait, that puts the general public at risk, and as you say, that should be your top priority? What do you say to that?
Well, that's assuming that everyone incarcerated is already contaminated, and that's not true. What I think we need to do is recognize that
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to clarify that. I think my question is other types of risks of future recidivism or committing other crimes, et cetera.
Right. But I think let's focus on our pretrial detainees. Those individuals have not been found guilty of anything yet. So I think many of your listeners that haven't gone to law school need to understand that a major tenet of what we stand for in the criminal justice system, or should, is you are innocent until proven guilty. But every single day in court, and I am the DA, and I, you know, can speak very clearly about this, every single day in court, bails are requested. And if you, Tiziana, have the money to pay that bail, you get out. And if I don't, I get sent to Nashua Street. And that is a socioeconomic impact on the poor, right? Irrespective of what their race is or other things. And if you are not violent or a threat to our society, but you simply can't pay your bail, I think it's too extreme a collateral consequence that we're sending you to a place where, by its definition, you are going to be in groups and you are going to be closer than 6 feet to people. And you are also not going to have hand sanitizer, soap, or the access to care that you might need.
And is this exclusively pretrial inmates? Is that who you're focusing on with this?
I think a lot of the requests that we're getting from the criminal defense bar, Tiziana, are with respect to the pretrial detainees. But there are also, we have a really significant aging population in that is incarcerated. So this is post-trial convictions, individuals that are close to finishing out their sentences, but might have some compromised, not COVID-19, but some health issues. That's a different sort of standard in analysis. There's a lot of requests for sort of compassionate release. That's the the lingo that people would use and understand is, if I'm 6 months away from getting out and serving a sentence that I had for, let's say, a five-year sentence that I received, and I am a person who's over 60, no COVID-19 yet, but, you know, have gotten in no trouble behind the wall, but my family is arguing, please let him out of there or her out of there, because, you know, if there's one person that contracts this, let's say at Sousa Baranowski or at Suffolk County House of Corrections, Nashua Street, it's almost going to be rapid fire that other people are contaminated.
I'm sorry to interrupt you here. We have so much to get to, and I do want to ask you, do you know how many inmates you're talking about and what kind of tracking, if any, you'd be doing once that number of inmates is released under this program?
Well, the mechanism by which they're released, Tiziana, is a defense counsel has to come forward and ask us. We are working with them every day to see if we can come up with lists of people that maybe there are assented to groups, and then there might be groups of individuals that we would contest their release. But, of course, their defense counsel has the ability to argue, no, we believe this should happen. So we're grouping individuals and groups of individuals. And what we're going to do is we're going to then try to work with the trial court, because ultimately, Tiziana, this is a judge's decision about whether people are released.
And
the
so to that end, D.A. Rollins, I do want to, I'm sorry again, I know I'm kind of interrupting a lot, but we have limited time. How does this affect then future arrests as well, based on how you've just explained to me the system works? Would this be open to defense attorneys of future arrests as well?
Well, so yes. Right now, we're excited to see across the country that members of law enforcement, for example, in Philadelphia, are saying that they're moving to a summons only with respect to nonviolent, non-serious crimes. So that means rather than arresting people, they're going to be issuing summons, and they're only going to be arresting individuals for serious violent crimes. That is not a free, you know, will allowance of crime. It's just saying that right now with our court systems closed, you will be held accountable. It just will be later.
Suffolk Attorney, I'm so sorry to interrupt. I appreciate you joining us, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. I hope you will come back to talk with us more about this in the future.
Of course.
Thanks. I appreciate your time today. We turn now to the T, which is making a lot of changes in response to the coronavirus. Joining us on the line now is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. Welcome back, Steve.
Thanks so much for having me.
And do you have questions for Steve Poftak about the T, concerns, things you want to know as schedules change and as the coronavirus outbreak unfolds? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. Steve, Tuesday, the MBTA decreased services across the board, but then it seemed that led to some overcrowding on certain lines. You've now added more service to the blue and the E on the green line to address that. Also added some more bus service for medical areas and government offices. Do you think you found the right balance, or is there going to be kind of a constant calibrating that you're going to need to do as things go forward?
I think, you know, we will continue to evaluate. We're also going to spend some time thinking about the commuter rail system as well, if we've got the right balance. So we will continue to evaluate. And we're in a position now where we do have the ability where we can add service in small increments in certain places for the time being. There may be a time where we don't have that luxury.
Massachusetts Nurses Association wrote a letter to Governor Baker recently saying that the state ought to shut down all public transportation except for essential, quote, essential personnel or individuals cleared to travel, Steve. And that's similar to the restrictions imposed during the blizzard of 1978. Is something like that on the table?
I think at least in the conversations I'm having, that's not on the table. I would say the general message that I've gotten from watching the governor and watching the mayor is that, you know, if the non-essential travel should be avoided. And I think obviously we want to serve folks who need, there's many folks who have to go to work. We want to be able to carry them. There's people going to medical facilities. We want to be able to serve them and also serve them in a way that I think is consistent with the social distancing we're talking about.
And do you feel like you've got enough capacity on the various lines now that people can take the T if they need to and maintain the appropriate social distancing of 6 feet apart, not too close together?
I do feel in most cases, but we are, you know, we are tracking reports of crowding, particularly on certain bus routes, and we're doing our best to try to get additional service there. Again, I will say for folks to avoid non-essential travel.
Let's take a call. We've got a caller on the line, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation and ask a question of MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. Pam is on the line from Concord. Pam, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Thank you, Manager Poftak. You have an impossible job. I've been taking the commuter rail for 30 years from Concord, and I grew up in Boston, so I have always, always used public transportation. I remember when the fare was 10 cents on the Red Line. I'm calling to ask, right now in the middle of this crisis with the federal government saying they're going to bail out cruise ships and airlines and hotels and God knows who else, why is there no buzz about any help for public transportation? My God. So what, if anything, does the T and state leadership who support the T and people like me who support the T plan on doing to put some screws around the federal government to squeeze out some long overdue money?
Yeah, let's give that to Steve Poftak, especially because the New York Times is reporting that the MTA in New York is asking for a $4 billion bailout themselves. So, Steve.
You know, I think right now it's early days to figure out. This is obviously going to have a large fiscal impact on the MBTA. We collect a little under $700 million a year in fares. Our ridership is down, depending on the mode you look at, 70 to 80%. So it's obviously going to have an impact. We have spent the last, we have been intensely involved in our organizational response to COVID-19 and our operational response to COVID-19. So we're really not at the point of, and also, I mean, I think the other part is there's so many unknowns here, right? No one can say with surety kind of the duration that we're going to be doing this.
Do you have some sense, though, Steve, of kind of a run rate? So if you're down 70 to 80% in ridership, and last I checked, about 40% of the T's revenues came from ridership, is there a tipping point where without a state or federal bailout, it just becomes untenable? Do you have any sense of what that run rate is?
We do, and we certainly have runway, and it's not it's not something that we're thinking about on a day-to-day basis. It is something we're going to need to sit back and assess, and I do think there is going to have to be some level of assistance. I also think, given the societal impact of this, there's going to be plenty of other entities that are going to need assistance as well. So I would say it's early days for us to be doing that, but it is something we're going to think about longer term. I mean, quite honestly, we have spent the last 2 weeks responding as an organization to just how are we going to run service, how are we going to organize ourselves to have this business continue to run under these conditions.
Steve, what is the top worry on a day-to-day basis right now?
I think the top worry is ensuring that we've got the workforce to run the system and run it reliably. And part of dropping the service level down is this is the level of service we believe that we can run reliably for a significant portion of time. This is obviously a stressful time for everyone. Everyone not only is juggling whatever they're trying to do professionally, but also it's been very stressful for families with children. I've been incredibly gratified and incredibly thankful for the response of the workforce. The folks out there on the front lines driving the buses and operating the trains have really responded. And, I think they are the ones who are owed an awful lot of credit.
Let's talk about them for a second, because the Baker administration is closing child care centers across the state by March 23rd. Some of those centers are staying open to care for children of emergency workers. So I guess the question is, do T employees count as emergency workers? Will they have access to some of that special child care that's being reserved open?
That is not currently envisioned. I think there would be other folks, particularly in the healthcare field, would get priority here. We haven't we have not had any interaction with early childhood on this. So how are you advising
your workers? You were talking about the sacrifices they're making, the families that they have, the stress that they're under, as so many employees are. How are you advising them on things like childcare?
I mean, I think we are, you know, we're trying to be understanding. We do need folks to show up, and they are showing up, and we're very grateful for that.
Let me ask you, we've been taking calls here for about 2 weeks now from listeners with concerns about the coronavirus, and, you know, safety from infection tends to be the number one call and concern. Can you walk listeners through how the cleaning is working at the MBTA? What is happening, how frequently, et cetera?
Sure. We are disinfecting every car, every vehicle. So every bus, every train car, every paratransit vehicle, we are disinfecting it every 24 hours. We are now ramping up. We're not quite there yet, but we hope to be there, I believe, by the end of the week, if not early next week, where we are also doing a midday cleaning of vehicles.
So twice a day versus once.
Yeah, and we are also cleaning what we're calling contact points. So we're not cleaning the whole station every 4 hours, but we're cleaning the places where people touch handrails, escalator rails, the fare machines with the buttons that folks would be touching with their hand. So we are trying to disinfect the system as best we can. And I think, you know, we are doing it at a tempo that is equivalent or better than any other transit system in the country.
All right. So last question for you. The world has changed clearly, but the T's needs haven't. Last time you and I talked, we talked about long-term repairs, maintenance, investment. Is any of that still on track in this new normal?
We are attempting to keep our capital program on track. I think we're always going to prioritize safety. Also, to support the capital program, we have to use the same folks who are maintaining the system. And you know, at some point, we're gonna run out of resources. We're gonna need to have those folks solely prioritized. So, you know, we're hopeful that we can get through this and continue the aggressive capital campaign. But obviously, we're going to prioritize safety and we're going to prioritize service as well. So, you know, it remains to be seen how long we'll be in this mode.
MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Joining us today to help take your calls is Dr. Joshua Barokas of Boston Medical Center and the Boston University School of Medicine. Welcome back, Dr. Barokas.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center. She's also the Treasurer of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Welcome back to you too, Dr. Boucher.
Thanks for having me.
And again, listeners, that number for your questions is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As people begin calling in, I do have a couple questions I'd like to ask the two of you first. There's some new CDC data that found that out of the U.S. cases from mid-February to March, 38% of those sick enough to be hospitalized were actually younger than 55. That seems to run counter to some early messaging that older adults were quite vulnerable and younger people, especially millennials, let's say, were fairly safe and immune. Has that been wrong? Is that not the case? Are we learning something different now? Maybe Dr. Barokas, can you answer?
So what I'll say is I think that what this highlights is the importance, and we've said this before on the program, both of us, I believe, have, that this really gets at the heart of physical distancing. You know, I believe that our messaging has been very clearly heard by a lot of the population, which is stay home, don't interact. But what we really need, what this is showing us, is that really we need to help target and help educate some of our younger population because they are at risk. This is a virus that, and just like any other virus, can change and it can affect people differently. We're learning new things every day thanks to the sharing of data from Italy and China and other countries that have been heavily affected. And so as we take in all that new data, the best thing that we can tell people to do is really, truly stay at home because this is an evolving situation.
And Dr. Boucher, as we've had physicians practicing in hospitals on these panels, we're constantly trying to gauge how bad is it in the hospital. So at Tufts Medical Center, does that reflect what we've been hearing there, you know, shortages of supplies, concerns about overwhelm of the number of beds? You know, we know that the head of Mass General today asked 3D printing companies to begin trying to print 3D masks, for example. So how bad is it at Tufts Medical Center right now?
Well, so I think, you know, the good news is that we've been preparing for many weeks and that we have a stockpile of supplies. I think the concerns that all of us share in all of our institutions here in Massachusetts and really across the country is that this supply is not endless and that we need to be prepared for a real influx of patients for a significant period of time. And so we're all thinking as creatively as possible and in community as much as possible about ways to be the most prepared. And so it's really gratifying to see these creative potential solutions being explored early in the epidemic while there's time to pursue them. And I think, you know, we're working at the local level with things like individual potential solutions, but also at the city, state, and national level to, try to influence our legislators and others to help us have access to the very important supplies that we need to protect our patients.
So our lines are filling up. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you have a question today for our panelists. Gordon's on the line from Concord. Gordon, please go ahead.
Thank you. My question is this. My 21-year-old niece on Saturday is returning from Sydney, Australia, where she's studying abroad. She's returning to a household that includes her 57-year-old mom, who's a type 1 diabetic, her 66-year-old uncle, who is recovering from a stroke, and her grandmother, who is 88 years old. All three are vulnerable, obviously. Is it safe for her to come into that home?
Great question, Gordon. Dr. Barocas?
So at this point, what I think many of us would recommend is as you are able to have returning travelers, because we're trying to understand asymptomatic transmission, the best thing to do is to have that family member either somewhere else for an observation period, a quarantined observation period, or if that's not possible, then to do the best possible job at separating her from the rest of the family.
So first choice is don't come back to the house, it sounds like. Second choice is isolate in the house. Is that right?
And that's exactly right. I mean, we understand that this is posing a hardship on a lot of families, and this does not my thoughts don't necessarily mean that I'm ignoring the limitations of family structures, but to the best extent possible, yes, it would be best if a returning traveler would go somewhere aside from the house, and if not, then isolate themselves.
That's really helpful. Let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Deanne's on the line from Watertown. Deanne, what's your question?
My question is this. So we know that this virus spreads airborne. So, and my question is, if it's airborne, and then we know these public places like grocery stores and the medical stores, so can they make sure the ventilation is, it's all ventilated better? Like maybe even opening the doors and leaving the doors open, I feel that it's much more ventilated than leaving the doors closed.
What about that, Dr. Boucher? What about, you know, grocery stores leaving the doors open, opening windows? I know it's cooler weather, but it is warming up. Does that level of increased ventilation make a difference, and is something like that important to do?
Well, great question. So just to clarify, this virus is actually spread by what we call droplets, like influenza. That's why we have the recommendations for keeping that distance to more than 6 feet, because we know that the droplets spread in a mostly 3, but up to 6 foot radius of where we're standing. So it's actually not airborne. It's not like tuberculosis. So that's an important thing to think about as we look at this. And then I think in general, you know, fresh air is a good thing. And, you know, wiping down surfaces, washing our hands, all the procedures that we've been talking about are very, very important for preventing spread of the virus.
We have Judy on the line from West Newbury. Judy, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm just curious as to whether when people seemingly healthy test positive for the virus, are they just testing the colonization in the nose, or do people actually have the virus, are asymptomatic, and develop antibodies?
And Dr. Barocas?
I'll take my answer later.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, and I love the discussion about colonization. At this point, we don't believe that if you're testing positive, that it's something such as colonization. And for a lot of the listeners, what that means is bacteria and are oftentimes are always living on our skin and our upper respiratory tracts. Many places, and we live with them in a very nice and harmonious way most of the time. We don't believe at this point, and at least what I've seen, that there's necessarily colonization, that it's living with us harmoniously. So if you're getting swabbed, even if you're asymptomatic, then that would mean that you are you have an infection. It may be very mild. It also may be so mild that it's what we would call subclinical. But just like anything, there is a spectrum of disease. So it can be anything from asymptomatic to severely ill. So if you have gotten a test and it has become positive for COVID-19, then you can assume that you are infected and need to be isolated.
So to briefly follow up on that before we take our next call, how long can someone be asymptomatic? Have it and be asymptomatic?
So the best data that we have so far, and if Dr. Boucher knows anything that I don't, I'm always ears to her. But as far as I know, you can be asymptomatic for the duration of what we would consider the illness, but you can also be asymptomatic before you start showing signs. That asymptomatic period can be up to and even longer than 5 days. And we know that people in general with a mild disease, once you've been diagnosed and you have some symptoms, you can be, you're shedding your virus for upwards of 14 and in some cases longer days beyond that.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you have a question for the panel. We've got Stephanie on the line from Wakefield.
Hi, yes. My question is in regards to smoking. We hear a lot of information about modifiable risks about, you know, social distancing and whatnot. And yet there seems to be very little in the public about the modifiable risk of smoking. We know that smoking is a risk factor, not a risk factor, but patients do worse who are smokers. And we know that, you know, if you do quit or reduce your smoking, that you'll see improvements in lung function within a month. And yet, as I said, there's very little in the news and the public service.
So let's turn that to Dr. Boucher, Helen. Stephanie, I understand your question. Dr. Boucher, what about what Stephanie's saying?
Yeah, it's a great point. Certainly, smoking is bad, and we know that in China, at least from the data from China, that smoking was a risk factor in many of the people who did badly with this virus. So I absolutely support any and all endeavors to get people to quit smoking and to think about the negative effects of smoking, because smokers will not do as well with this virus like many other diseases.
1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Nora is on the line from New Bedford. Nora, go ahead.
I was wondering, why should the U.S. close schools if the U.K. isn't closing schools?
It's a great question, Nora. It sounds like you are in school yourself. Is your school closed?
Yes.
Yeah, right, because they all are now. Okay, let's go to Dr. Barocas, and see if he's got an answer for you.
So every decision is obviously has to be weighed on a city-by-city, state-by-state, and even country-by-country basis. At this point, where we are in our virus, and I can't speak for the United Kingdom, where we are in the epidemiology and the spread of our virus and how the number of cases that we know that closing schools for at least a period of time, which will encourage what we call physical distancing or social distancing, is going to help stop the spread through our communities. Remember, Nora, a lot of teachers and kids are also struggling with various diseases that put them at risk. And so part of this is being a member of the community and making sure that our community as a whole is safe. And that's what closing the schools is meant to do.
Let's take a call from Cindy in Dedham. Cindy, please go ahead. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for this program. The question I had to do with more on the positive side. If people come through this individually, having survived it or been exposed and showing no symptoms, have they developed an immunity to the virus automatically? I don't know, just if they're exposed again, are they immune, or
great
how
question.
Does that process happen?
Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, it's a great question. And the good news is that the data that we've seen so far, and again, we're still learning a lot about this virus, but the data that we've seen so far shows that people do develop immunity. And that's partly how we know about this percentage of people who have extremely mild or no disease, is because we find antibodies in those people. So we know they've been exposed and developed immunity. And we have signs that immunity is what we call protective, and that it lasts for a long time. So that's a good thing. And we look forward to learning more about it. There are a lot of people studying this quite intensively right now.
Jessica's on the line from Topsfield. Jessica, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. My question is, can a vinegar and water solution be effective in disinfecting surfaces that may have been touched by the virus?
Great question. Dr. Barocas.
I have not looked into that, and I know that there are a lot of solutions out there. We have been recommending a bleach-based solution, but I'm going to ask if Dr. not to put her on the spot, but Dr. Boucher,
let's turn to you, Dr. Boucher. I don't know either. How about you, Dr. Boucher?
Put me on the spot. So my understanding is that standard cleaners that we use at home and in the hospital work. I have not specifically seen vinegar listed as an ingredient, but again, the recommendations from the CDC say that standard cleaners for our homes and the hospital work fine for this virus.
Any standard cleaning product that you would use at another time.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay, that's really helpful. Let's see if we can get one more. We've got Gina on the line from North Reading. Gina, go ahead.
Hi there. My question is about the exposed produce in grocery stores and whether, say, somebody sneezes over the broccoli, can the virus live on the food?
Okay. Dr. Barocas or Boucher, either one.
I can start and try to answer. So we have some newer data saying how long the virus can live on surfaces. And we do know that it can survive on certain surfaces and in the air for a number of hours. So what I would say, we all have to have food, and we all have to go to the grocery store. As you're going to the grocery store, make sure that you're wiping down the cart or the basket as you're walking in. Anything that you're grabbing, such as the exposed fruit or exposed vegetables, make sure that you're cleaning that really well before you eat it. And obviously, when you get home, I do want to just make sure everybody hears you have to wash your hands for your two ABC songs, as we say to my two kids. But yes, it can, and I would encourage you to wash that produce.
This has been Dr. Joshua Barocas of Boston Medical Center and the Boston University School of Medicine. Thanks, Dr. Barocas.
Always a pleasure.
And Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks so much, Dr. Boucher.
Thank you for having me.
And stay with us. Coming up, what we can learn from another pandemic more than 100 years ago. Yesterday, on our show, we got a rare opportunity to look into the future and learn some coronavirus lessons from Italy, where they are ahead of us in the infection curve. But what about lessons from the past? Turns out they're available, too, from the 1918 flu outbreak right here in Boston. Joining us now via Skype is Robert Allison, professor of history at Suffolk University and author of a number of books, including The American Revolution and A Short History of Boston. Professor Allison, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
Also with us on the line is Dr. Skip Desjardin. He's the head of sports for YouTube TV and author of September 1918, War, Plague, and the World Series. Skip, welcome to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
I almost accidentally gave you a medical degree there. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I don't want anybody coming to seek any advice from me on a medical basis.
Fair enough. All right. Professor Allison, I do want to start with you. Boston was actually, I didn't really realize that Boston was basically a ground zero for the Spanish flu in 1918, the site of the first major outbreak in the nation. Why? Why did that happen here?
Well, it really happened here because of the mass mobilization for the war. That is, Boston was the major shipping point for getting men, supplies, nurses off to Europe. So the South Boston waterfront was actually where the first flu cases were reported at what's now Commonwealth Pier, and very quickly overwhelmed the medical establishment in the city. And plus, you had 50,000 servicemen out at Fort Devon. So between these two places, you have, and you also, the flu had started somewhat mysteriously. We know the first cases in the United States were out in Kansas back in the spring, and then the virus had migrated to Europe and then to Asia and back. Kind of misnamed the Spanish flu because the first cases were reported in Spain, and Spain being a neutral country, the Allies were kind of sore that a flu bug started there.
It started in Kansas, but was first reported in Spain?
Well, we didn't have the kind of global system of communication that we do today. So there were flu cases being reported in Kansas, flu cases being reported in Spain, flu cases being reported in other parts of the world. No one really was connecting these particular dots. And three major shipping points in the Atlantic, Dakar in Senegal, Brest in France, and Boston in North America, really were the kind of the triangle through which the virus spread and mutated as it was spreading.
So, Skip, as you write in your book, this kind of all came to a head in September of 1918. Why was that month kind of the perfect storm for the virus?
Well, as the professor explained, the first cases showed up on the waterfront in Boston, and the movement of troops, the movement of sailors, the movement of civilians in and out of military facilities meant that it spread very quickly. Much like coronavirus today, you could be infected for quite some time before your symptoms showed up. And so the foremost expert on infectious diseases in the entire country, Dr. Milton Rosenau, was stationed at the Chelsea Naval Hospital at the Boston waterfront, and he saw patient number one. He knew what it was. He did exactly the right thing in treating and isolating that sailor, but it was too late. That person had already infected too many other people, and they couldn't contain the virus. And in many ways, the math of a pandemic is sometimes more frightening than the science of it.
So for either of you, you know, hygiene is such an important part of our fight of the coronavirus, constant disinfecting surfaces, washing hands. What was daily life like in Boston then? And what kind of hygiene was available to try to fight the spread?
It was a lot dirtier then. In fact, you see the warnings about spitting on the street. That was the 1918 equivalent of don't spit on the street, keep your windows open. By the way, my grandmother at the time was working, selling drugstore supplies. So she would come up from New York on the train, and people she saw on Monday taking their orders, by the time she came back on Thursday, those people were dead. The virus hit very quickly. But she also said people were crazy to get Listerine. They thought Listerine could stop the spread of the virus. And the head of the city's public health commission thought the biggest thing we can do is clean up the restaurants. The restaurants have dirty pots and pans, and he thought that was really a way of spreading the virus. Probably not, but we learn things from this that maybe we should always remember. Wash your hands. Don't spit on the street. use Listerine. These are good recommendations at any time, and it's unfortunate we need a pandemic to remind us.
Well, and I guess I should ask then, does that mean that the Spanish flu was aerosolized or in droplets, and that's how it spread the way coronavirus is now?
Yeah, it absolutely was. And one of the mitigating factors was that because people were not yet symptomatic in the city, they took no sort of social distancing precautions.
Right.
Here was the World Series being played at Fenway Park and putting 35,000 people shoulder to shoulder inside the park. And there were also five enormous parades in the city during that month, from Labor Day to Liberty Loans, which just created a soup of microbes and infection.
So, you're making me panicky just listening to this. Skip, you're also making me think maybe it was, in fact, a really good idea to cancel sports under the circumstances. I mean, I'm picturing a World Series and everybody's, sharing peanuts and standing together. Professor Allison, so talk a little bit about the early government response as this began to unfold at the state level or local or federal.
Well, the governor happened to be out of town, and the mayor didn't take – there's actually a famous photograph of Mayor Peters getting a flu shot. This was to show that we're handling things. And the public health commissioner was not as concerned as he might have been. There are – as Skip said, the Navy's response was absolutely what they should do, isolate these the sailors. However, the city and the state were a little slower to respond to this, not to fault them. I mean, they wanted to avoid panic. So the guy who was actually in charge on the ground here was Calvin Coolidge, who is elected governor in November, and he's acting as lieutenant governor. So they are coordinating among these different agencies, which often don't get along very well together. The state public health commission, the city public health commission, the Red Cross, the city government, the schools. Actually, the superintendent of schools didn't think it was necessary to cancel school because he thought the kids would be safer in school than they would be at home. And in school, they have trained nurses. And what quickly happened was the doctors and nurses started getting sick, too. So they were stricken with the flu and weren't able to tend to this huge number of patients. They did set up the Navy wound up setting up tents on in Brookline. There's a huge field covered with tents for the sick personnel from the Navy. So the response very, very quickly, the state and the city were overwhelmed. And there was an expectation at the beginning, the virus, since it's so strong, it's going to burn itself out pretty quickly.
So, go ahead, and then I'll ask.
There was also a political undertone to all of that, in which the federal government, and to a lesser extent the state government, had a vested interest in people not panicking, as the professor said, but in continuing to go about their daily lives. They needed people to be out at these parades to get worked up and excited about the war and buy war bonds.
Right.
They needed people to go to work on the factory floor to build ships and manufacture guns and turn out boots and blankets and sort of telling people that they should stay home, as good as that might be for their health, would have been a tremendous drag, not only on the economy, but on the war effort.
So wait, was that an actual sort of moral calculus? Am I hearing, we know this is bad, we know this is an outbreak, we know we should tell people to stay away, but if we do, the war effort will suffer, and therefore we're not going to tell people what we know? Is that what you're saying?
I think it was less a calculus than it was so ingrained in society and in government that every aspect of our daily lives should revolve around supporting the war effort that alternatives never occurred to them.
So, Robert, what is your assessment of the flow of information from government? How long into this before the response was proportionate to the risk?
Well, quite honestly, the federal government's focus, as Skip said, was on the war. And that was the entire focus. Great novel, if you're interested, by Catherine Ann Porter, Pale Horse, Pale Rider, when she's stricken with a flu. And in the background, there is this current about selling war bonds. Who has bought more war bonds? That was really the focus, which is why, as Skip said, we needed the parades. We needed these things. So it's less the case of the government sinisterly saying, we're not going to tell people what we know. The government really didn't know all that much. It was the federal government, the city government, the state government weren't really set up to deal with a crisis like this. It was the doctors, the public health commission, and the Navy doctors. and information wasn't spreading as quickly then as it does now. And fortunately, misinformation didn't spread as quickly either. So the city was really overwhelmed, I think. And because Boston, the city and the state have kind of different interests, there's always been that kind of a clash.
Skip, looking back now in your research for the book, is there any consensus of something that should have been done then, that the city should have done and didn't do?
Yeah, I think the consensus is they should have acted faster and earlier, and taken the kind of steps that we have taken today. Close the schools, close restaurants, close theaters, and it just didn't happen. And Bob's right that misinformation prevailed. You know, at one point in the middle of September 1918, the U.S. Surgeon General put out a statement that said to avoid the Spanish flu, people should not wear tight shoes.
What?
Right. Yeah.
So that was the level of information that was coming from the government. Yeah. And so you can see why thousands and thousands of people were stricken. And if you look at the numbers of how many people were sick and died just in the city of Boston back then, compared to what we're dealing with today, it is astounding.
It is.
So how did it
end? 3,500 people died by early October. 3,500. There were hundreds of people dying every day. People in South Boston remember the caskets stacked on a lawn across from a funeral home. Remember, many of the sailors were at Commonwealth Pier. But I mean, it simply overwhelmed our capacity both to fathom it and to deal with this huge tragedy.
And to be clear, when was the first case? Was it August?
Like the last couple of days of August, a sailor checked into the Naval Hospital.
And you've got 3,500 people dead by October just in Boston.
Yeah, we've got 250 cases in Massachusetts today, total.
Right.
In the third week of September 1918, there were 85,000 cases in the state of Massachusetts.
Okay. All right. So, Robert Ellison, how does it end?
Well, it ends because the virus does ultimately wear itself out. Another really striking thing about this epidemic was it mainly struck young, healthy people. People between the ages of about 18 and 30 were the most heavily affected. In fact, their death rate skyrockets. And later on, it catches up with the old and the young, who usually are the victims of an epidemic like this. So it ends as viruses do. The virus pretty much burns itself out. I'm not an epidemiologist. You've had plenty of those. I mean, I'm not a doctor, as Skip said. I'm not that kind of doctor, so don't ask me medical advice.
All right, fair enough. Skip, one last lesson that you took from your research in writing this book that's important for the city of Boston today.
Listen to doctors. Listen to scientists, because math and science are true. Do not listen to politicians.
All right. And on that note, that is Skip Desjardins. He's the head of sports for YouTube TV and author of September 1918, War, Plague, and the World Series. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Robert Allison is professor of history at Suffolk University and author of a number of books, including A Short History of Boston. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tiziana.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, and that's Boston's NPR news station.